1, 2, 3, hit it, boy. Ah.
So get together, have a few laughs.
Uh-oh. Shit, lady, do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
Lady, put the freaking gun down on the ground right now. Take your son across the freaking street and say that until he's gonna get you.
Hi, I'm Josh Carter.
And I'm Kendrick Martin, and you're listening to Where There's a Willis, There's a Way. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, what we do here is an in-depth breakdown of a movie starring Bruce Willis, both from a film perspective and his individual contribution. Today we're going to be talking about Fast Food Nation, but we've discussed all sorts of movies here. We'll talk trivia and then do the Wheel of Willis.
You can find our previous episodes at williswaypod.com. We're also a proud part of the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network, so follow along to listen to other podcasts about action movies and other action hero stars. Thanks for supporting this podcast at anchor.fm/willis-way. If you ever want to support us for free, you can leave us a review on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Lastly, be sure to tell everyone you know about our project, since we all need a little bit more Bruce Willis in our lives.
If you want to email us with a comment, correction, or a picture of your cat, you can do that by sending an email to williswaypod@gmail.com. You can also find us on all sorts of social media at williswaypod. There is a Facebook page for the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network, and you can head on over to lastoftheactionheroes.com. And we also have a Discord where we do some live episode recordings, we discuss the different shows, all sorts of stuff happens, and we'll have info for joining that in our show notes. Today, we're going to be talking about Fast Food Nation, directed by Richard Linklater, written by Eric Schlossler and Richard Linklater.
Before we dive into the main discussion, we want to give our listeners a quick and easy way to decide if this is the movie for them. Not every Bruce Willis movie can be Die Hard, because that would be too many Die Hard movies back to back to back to back. And not every movie can even reach Die Hard levels either. So we want to give you an idea if this movie is going to be one where you should go watch it first and come back and listen to the discussion, or if you're better off just listening to a couple of bozos talk about this movie and rest assured that you are not missing out.
So Josh.
Yeah, what's
up? We have a rating system, which, listening to you describe this, I really think we should have rated movies a Die Hard out of a Die Hard, but I guess we didn't know at the beginning what to rate things. So we are rating them a Bruce Willis out of a Bruce Willis. The more letters we give, the higher we think it is valued. Anything over a Bruce we think is worth you taking the time, listener, to go watch. All that said, Joshua, what do you rate Fast Food Nation?
Definitely not above a Bruce, for sure. I think I probably would give it somewhere in the BR, or maybe BRU range. So either a Brockter or a Bruh. What about you?
I'm going to say Bruce Space.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Space, yeah.
Nice.
I have a hunch. I know where our differing thoughts come from, but I guess we'll find out.
This will be interesting. So, without any further ado, we're going to get into our discussion on the Bruce Willis classic Fast Food Nation.
Exactly. I'm saying there's in the meat.
Mm-hmm. tastes like it's right off the grill.
You don't think it needs like liquid smokes?
No. No. I think it's perfect.
All right. That audio is from the trailer of Fast Food Nation. I'm going to go ahead and read that description from IMDb. The description is as follows. An examination of the health risks involved in the fast food industry, as well as its environment and social consequences. And you can find this movie on Max, aka the one to watch, aka the place where you cannot find Batgirl or Looney Tunes live action movies that are currently being thrown in the trash unceremoniously.
Too soon. Too soon. Have you heard all the things about how they're going to make a sequel to Roger Rabbit about an executive whose tunes are disappearing because accountants are just throwing them in the trash?
Oh my God. That's amazing. Yeah. I love that idea.
Pretty funny idea. Too soon. Yeah. I realized that as we were listening to that trailer audio, that it's mostly a visual trailer. And so I hope our podcast listeners liked some smooth guitar, because that's mostly what
that's basically what it is. It's like, yeah, tippity tap tap, text on the screen.
Yeah,
tippity
tap, yeah, tap, bunch of text on the screen.
Which is good to know that like they've learned all the right lessons from Buster Keaton and have brought it into the modern era.
Yeah, Buster Keaton, known for great trailers.
Yeah. I'm just saying, text on screen and music in the background is like all that they had for dialogue.
True. True. Before we get into like an in-depth overview on the movie, I don't love this movie, but I didn't hate it as much as you. And I saw your Letterboxd review and I knew, I was like, oh, Josh hates this movie. have you watched any other Richard Linklater movie?
I have not, no. So I do have Boyhood on my watch list. So I am looking forward to that because I've heard good things about it, and I'm really curious to see what that movie looks like. I have watched School of Rock, so I should have looked at that before I said anything. I've watched School of Rock, and that's the only one. I'm also interested in watching A Scanner Darkly. I'm interested in watching just for the filmmaking technical aspects of it, but I've only watched School of Rock, and that's the only one so far.
Yeah, School of Rock he directed, he didn't write, which the rest of these I'm about to mention he wrote, which I feel like makes a huge difference. But the Before trilogy, with Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, are some of my top five favorite movies of all time. Really shaped like what I want in a movie. Basically the concept there is Ethan Hawke and Julie Delphi play a couple that are in the Before Sunrise is the first one, and it's set in the early 90s, and they kind of stumble across each other in like a town in Europe. And the whole movie is just them like getting to know each other and being like, who are you? And then the movie ends, they have to get on separate trains at sunrise. And so they have to decide like what they want to do with their life before sunrise. And then 10 years pass in real life, and they film a sequel where 10 years have passed, and they bring all the same actors back, and they're like, oh, hey, how's your life or whatever. And then, I want to say like 15 years pass. I'm not sure when Before Midnight came out. 2013. Yeah, so 11 years pass. And they film another one. Same actors. Yeah, you're right. Same actors. And 11 years have passed in their life. And it's just this great way of we're watching a story unfold. And they're aging in real life. So they're aging in the episode, and all these movies are just the two of them going through life, like talking and experiencing things and like having philosophical discussions. Wonderful, love them. But that style of like fluidity is not for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see that a little bit in Fast Food Nation. And I was in like a lot of his cameos are people who are in these other movies, like mm-hmm. Ethan Hawke, for example. But I was also reminded of this movie Slacker, which came out in 1990. And that's set in Austin, Texas. And it just follows a guy wandering around Austin, Texas. And it is extremely hard to describe, but the whole movie is him wandering around Austin, Texas. And he's like a young dude. And he'll like bump into things and talk to people and like maybe work a little bit and then get off work and smoke a cigarette. And it's just like extremely like disconnected. Mm-hmm. And he meets people and he'll have a conversation with them. And then you'll never see that person again for the rest of the movie. And I think in Fast Food Nation, that was like a common motif of, oh, we get a little slice of all this stuff, but then we never go back to it again.
Yeah.
And I think if you've never watched these other things, that feels really jarring. Mm-hmm. But I was like, oh, this is just kind of his like style of doing stuff. I don't know how well it worked. And I think part of my problems with this movie are it felt like there was a serious message to convey, but I don't know how much it trusted its audience to take it seriously. And so it couldn't decide if it wanted to be sarcastic or if it wanted to actually be serious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So long ramble, but how does that resonate with you and what you thought about while watching this?
Yeah. I mean, like that was something that I'm not used to seeing. I'm used to seeing a pretty, pretty straightforward sort of movie. I grew up in what I like to call the Marvel era of movie making, and so I like a good simple story in a lot of ways. I am okay with like a lot of characters popping in and out and being there and sharing a movie between multiple different characters and perspectives and stuff like that. It just didn't really ever feel like the movie took the time to pay off the audience sitting there to see all these extra characters interact with people adjacent to other stories and stuff like that. It felt like the movie should have either gone in a direction of connecting the stories a little bit more or making them even a little bit more separate. Because it's just like, I so just wanted to see any of these characters meet any of the other characters whatsoever. And I get that that's kind of also a little bit of the point, but that to me was pretty unsatisfying. And also I felt unsatisfied just as a movie watcher for getting the slice of lives of any of these characters, but there not being any resolution to anything that really happens in the movie. And so you're just kind of like, what am I here for? Cause the movie has such a clear intention with the messaging that I got it 30 minutes into the movie. I felt like it didn't have too much to say after that point that hadn't already been said, other than maybe the last couple of shots. So it just kind of, to me, felt a little bit underwhelming and unrewarding as a watch in that way.
Yeah. This was a movie where the subtext was the text, and like, it's almost 2 hours, and it came out in 2006, and I'm kind of hard pressed to like put myself in my 2006 mind as to what I thought about like the food industry. So a little bit of background. I haven't eaten red meat in probably 15 years, and for probably like 6 years I was like full vegetarian, but and for a variety of reasons that I don't need to get into, but a lot of it being like how our meat industry works.
Mm-hmm.
And like the creation of meat and all that. And so I was fairly familiar personally with like all the details that you learned throughout this about what goes into making cheap fast food.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious, I don't know like what the public thought in 2006 about some of the stuff. Like, was this as sort of like eye-opening as it seems to think that it is? because the trailer sort of plays up, and even the movie poster plays up this New York Times quote that's like, this is the most important movie since Fahrenheit 9/11 or whatever. And I was like, what? I don't know anyone today that you would go to and be like, are you surprised to find out that fast food is made terribly and like treats its workers terribly and the quality of the product is terrible? Like, I don't know. That just feels so normalized.
Yeah.
And people still consume it. They're just like, yeah, well, it's a dollar or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that there's also maybe been some reflection of fast food companies in the years since this has been made. Like the, you'll see like Burgerville, which is a chain in the northwest of the United States. They have pretty well come along on the idea of, yeah, we're going to source our meat as locally as possible. They're a local sourcer sort of a thing. And I believe the same is true of In-N-Out. I think that that's another chain that generally tries to do a pretty good job of doing locally sourced foods. But even local sourcing doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to, it's going to be completely ethical. And obviously we can analyze the inethicality or the lack of ethics in the food industry. And it's going to eventually come down to whatever's going to get the maximum value for the shareholders. And sometimes that is sourcing stuff ethically if they get in trouble for being so unethical, but oftentimes it's being just unethical enough to not get caught and still make the most amount of money possible. So I think that people are aware of it, like you're saying, and there is some shifting over time. Like, I don't think the fast food industry is necessarily the same that it was 18 years ago when this came out, but I also don't know that it's shifted so entirely that something like this isn't relevant today. It definitely still feels very relevant.
Yeah, I mean, capitalism really requires that you act in the best interest of the dollar. Well, let's get into it. So I think what we're going to do is, this movie is essentially three storylines that are slightly connected. And they, throughout the movie, they're stitched together as you watch them. And I think what we're going to do here is just talk through each storyline individually. And I'll read the, there's a, on Wikipedia, there's like a paragraph breakdown for each plot line. So I can just read through that and then we can kind of talk about how we felt about that and then move on to the next one.
Sounds good.
Sound good? All right. So the first story, and probably what I would say is the main story of this movie, follows Don Anderson, who's a, is the Mickey Hamburger Chain marketing director who helps develop the Big One, its most popular menu item. When he learns that independent research has shown a considerable presence of fecal matter in the meat, he travels to the fictitious town of Cody, Colorado, to determine if the local Uniglobe meat processing plant, which is Mickey's main supplier, is guilty of sloppy production. Don's tour shows only the pristine work area and the most efficient procedures, assuring him that even everything the company produces is immaculate. Suspicious of the facade he's been shown, Don meets rancher Rudy Martin, who used to supply cattle to Uniglobe. Rudy and his Chicana housekeeper both assure him that because of the plant's production levels, several safety regulations are ignored or worked against. Workers have no time to make sure that the manure coming from the intestines stays away from the meat. Don later meets with Harry Rydell, executive VP of Mickey, who admits being aware of the issue but is not concerned. I also want to mention that Harry Rydell is Bruce Willis, and we'll talk about Bruce Willis in particular, but that felt like a very strange, let's get a famous person for this 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the movie takes place around this meat processing plant, which, again, as someone who doesn't eat red meat, was like really hard to watch because it is filmed in an actual meat processing plant. Mm-hmm. And they show at the end of this, they show cattle being slaughtered. That's used like from actual meat processing plants. So you're like watching live cows actually being killed. And it's pretty graphic. I mean, I don't think anybody really has a... I don't think anyone has any like illusions as to where our meat comes from. But just watching this whole process, there was like a lot of just like making food is gross. Mm-hmm. And you're in it for a lot of this. What are your thoughts on this section of the movie?
Yeah, I mean, this is when I thought that it was kind of a pretty straightforward movie. And then I was like, oh, what are we doing showing the immigrants? Because it like would randomly cut from what the trailer shows, the like Don Anderson plot line, to just another few people. And you're like, what is going on? And then you start to piece together what this movie sort of is with the three different storylines, which like the trailer doesn't give away really at all. But I liked this storyline enough. It did feel maybe a little bit quaint nowadays, considering the fact that I feel like I'm probably moderately educated about meat compared to those around me. Like there's probably 50% of the people that are more educated about it, 50% that are less. But I think that generally people are aware kind of that whole process and everything like that. And so this Don Anderson thing, it didn't really speak to me a whole ton. We'll get to the Bruce Willis stuff later, but that his whole storyline was just kind of like a person super out of touch discovering, oh my God, this thing is bad. And it's like, yeah, we all know that it's bad. I don't really know that we needed this portion of the movie as much. I can't say that the performances were terrible or anything like that. It was all pretty steady across the board, but yeah, it didn't really speak to me that much.
I think, like, and again, I don't know if this is like a product of the time or what, but I think what the movie and this is based on a book, we should say. I don't remember if we mentioned that before, but it is based on a book, and I don't know if it is trying to skewer capitalism. I think it is trying to skewer capitalism, but I think it's doing so via this sort of like mass production lens. Mm-hmm. And I think it may be because it doesn't want to go as hard on capitalism in order to like not alienate its audience.
Or to even get produced in the first place.
Right. And I think there's like they briefly mentioned, oh, we have to cut all these corners because that's like we have to move fast. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh well, you shouldn't do that, that's bad. And they're like, yeah, well, that's what we got to do. And I wish it had spent a little more time. Like the Don character is kind of supposed to be the audience surrogate because he's discovering this along with us as to like what's going on. And at the end, you kind of are left with like he feels naive because he's their marketing director. He should have some idea as to, oh yeah, we have to crank out 9 million burgers a day, so of course there's going to be corners cut. And I wish I'd seen a little more of him wrestling with like, okay, what would it if we did slow down and like not so that it's also like via these plot lines, you find out that not only are they sloppy in their meat production and getting manure in the meat, they're also continually having employees get hurt and like mm-hmm. lose hands, lose legs. And it felt a subtle moment, but there's a moment where you see them showing a workplace safety video in the meatpacking plant, and the little clip we see, it's just like so blaming. It's like if you get hurt, it's your fault. Yeah. And you're responsible for not getting hurt, and if anything bad happens, it's because of you. So yeah, don't screw up and don't get hurt. Like that was the essential message of this, and I was like, I want to see more of that. I want to see more of like the company's putting the bottom line first, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. And we sort of like hint at that often throughout this, but it never really goes into it.
Yeah. It's never like directly confronted in a way that feels like it should be.
And the way it ends is I don't think the Don character really grapples with, he's never asked like, okay, it's going to cost an extra 50 cents a burger to improve safety. And mm-hmm. then he never is like, oh, well, that's, yeah, you're right. That's not worth it. We have to have these burgers be cheap, which there is a moment where he goes to, so he flies out to Cody, Colorado to visit this meatpacking plant and visits the local Mickey's and orders like a burger and a chocolate milkshake. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less than $5. And I was like, oh my gosh, that is wild. And also, this is after he finds out that the fecal content of the meat is off the charts. And I was like, who would eat a burger after finding that out? I was like, shocked. But yeah, so it's definitely cheap. And I don't, again, remember 18 years ago or whatever it is, but I think that's cheap for then too. But yeah, I wish there had been more sort of grappling with the realities. Cause at the end he's just like, all right, I'm back at it. We're going to make a barbecue version of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, like we said earlier, it's kind of the, the film is afraid to push the actual message that it probably should have been pushing with that story. And so it just comes off as kind of bland. Whereas they had like a glorious opportunity there to take it a little one step further, two steps further, like you said,
mm-hmm.
show us the repercussions and show us him grappling with it. And instead you don't get any of that. So yeah, agreed.
Yep. Anything else before I move on to the next plot line?
The only other thing is that I was going to say that I really like Kris Kristofferson. I believe that's his name.
Oh yeah.
He's a joy. Yep. So
yeah, he plays the Rudy Martin rancher.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that whole bit was great where he, Don shows up and then Rudy's like, hey, can you get out and open that fence for me? And
oh, that's so good.
Can you climb over this for like,
yeah,
he was,
yeah.
I liked
that. And I liked the kind of the brief examination that you got with the suburb versus rural kind of conflict, but all of these things are good things that I think would make interesting concepts to delve into further, but instead it's like, oh, we're gonna show him like having a conversation with his family, and I don't know that that necessarily gave me more value than what this other thing would have been. So I see in a lot of ways the film, it feels a little bit directionless with some of the stuff, or it has no teeth, and so therefore it feels like it has to pad in all this extra stuff. I don't know what the issue is there, but yeah.
Yep. All right. So moving on to the next storyline. Amber is a young, upbeat employee of Mickey's studying for college and living with her mother, Cindy. Sorry, I'm all over the place today. While her life seems to be set, she continually faces the contrast between her current career and her own ambition, emphasized by her two lazy coworkers, Brian and Andrew, who, having heard of armed robberies at fast food restaurants in the area, start planning their own. Amber and Amber and Cindy are visited by Cindy's brother Pete, who encourages Amber to leave town and start a real career. Amber eventually meets with a group of young activists, Andrew, Alice, and Paco, who plan to liberate cattle from Uniglobe as their first act of rebellion. They proceed to sneak up to a holding pen at the plant, and after breaking down the fence, they are shocked the cattle make no attempt to leave. After hearing the police, they retreat and contemplate why the cattle decided to stay in confinement. This is probably my least favorite plotline, although I loved the interactions. I thought that the meat, pun intended, of this, what felt the weakest.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is one that I think could have been a good movie if it was fleshed out a little bit more and Yet she got to know Amber and what her motivations were and everything like that. Because it feels like the world is just happening around her. And in some ways that feels accurate of my early 20s or late teens. But in other ways, it's not always the most engaging thing to watch. And again, feels a little bit directionless. I think I liked this one maybe a smidge more than the Don Anderson one, but it definitely wasn't my favorite either. I really, really liked the interactions that you got to see, though, with the Ethan Hawke character, with the Patricia Arquette character, and the activist stuff at the end, I think, really, really lets this plot line down, just because it's written so poorly, I think. Mm-hmm. There's a line where the activists are talking to, like, you can't do that, it's against the Patriot Act. And then another guy with like long 2006 hair is sitting, and also Avril Lavigne is also in this conversation too. So it really, it heightens that 2006 energy. But the guy with the long hair, bad boy, says, I can't think of anything more patriotic than violating the Patriot Act. And I wanted to end my movie watching experience right then and there. I was so frustrated with just how stupid everything was. Cause a lot of, I think my problem as somebody who tends to be a part of, activist groups or adjacent to activist groups is that, maybe they're a little bit overzealous sometimes, but usually they are, well-informed, and that either leads them down a path of extreme nihilism, or that leads them down a path of extreme, like, technocratic sort of analysis. And it felt like this just didn't have any of that. And I was kind of left wondering what I was supposed to gain from this experience watching them do this. It just felt like, yeah, let's make fun of kids for a little bit and their dumb idealism. But then the movie is also trying to make fun of the companies and their stuff. So they have the same critique that the kids do. They're just like, what if our critique was bad and coming from kids? So, yeah.
Yeah, it felt to me really out of place, because we're witnessing, it's focusing a lot on like the mundanity and sort of the like weird in between place that fast food jobs can be, which I think in itself is a interesting critique on how we view employment and like what, like minimum wage. You know, you'll hear politicians say minimum wage is not supposed to be a livable wage. Minimum wage is supposed to be a thing that we give teenagers because we want to extract value from teenagers, but they're living at home, so they don't need to pay rent. And if people, you know, if older people who aren't teenagers have to work there, well, that's too bad. Yeah, that's too bad on
them.
Learn
to code.
That's their fault. Yeah, right. And I think it's this sort of like we've separated the career element or the like job fulfillment element. And it's just sort of like we just need bodies in here to slap some stuff on a grill and call it good. And I kind of was like, oh, that's maybe where we're going to evaluate like life. And she's going to be like, do I have a direction in life? The Paul Dano character was kind of an interesting comparison. And then she, even her talking to her mom, because it's she, her Patricia Arquette is like a single mom. And she's like, why are you studying all the time? Like, I didn't study nearly as much as you. And Amber's like, well, yeah, because I want good grades and like I have all these ambitions in life. And I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of examination. And then all of a sudden she's like, and now I'm at a activist group where we're going to go commit crimes. And I was like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
And then Avril Lavigne, also funny. And then I was looking it up. She was in Over the Hedge. So we have we're two for two so far.
Yeah. Which, and she didn't do a ton of acting, so it's very funny.
Yeah, I know.
Two hours in a row.
Yeah. And then what irked me the most about that ending, trying to free the cattle, is my guess is, I would bet money that the whole point of this was so that the very end, when the cattle won't leave, They could say, why won't the cattle leave? Is it just nice enough inside the pen that they won't escape for freedom? And then it cuts to the third plot line, which is all about employees being treated terribly. And I was like, oh, this whole thing was a setup so they could say, are we the cattle stuck in something we can't escape because it's too comfortable? I'm like, come on.
Yeah. It's like they're making fun of the kids for being dumb with their activism, and then they say that and they're expecting us to be like, nah, that's profound. It's like, nah.
So I had texted Josh when I saw this, because there's a movie that came out last year and it's nominated for some Academy Awards, and it's called How to Blow Up a Pipeline. And it is, I believe, also based on a book. And it is essentially...
For a second, I thought you were going to say also starring Avril Lavigne. And I was like, no way. No way.
I actually don't remember who it stars. I don't think it's got a bunch of well-known actors in it. But it's the plot is essentially a group of activists who plan to blow up a oil pipeline in Wyoming, I think. Wyoming or Texas, I don't remember. And all the work they go into in discussing, like, is this what we want? What is the point of this? Like, what are we trying to do? What are our goals? If we just blow up a pipeline and then the company's going to come out and fix it again, like, what's the point of that? Like, it's this discussion on all of that while also showing people that are like, okay, we're doing the planning, we're doing the work. They don't have a character who's like long hair, pot smoking guy who just like is there for, like, it's not anarchists. It's like people who are actually trying to commit to what they believe in. And yeah, it's really interesting. And I was kind of like, that shows you how you could have a group of activists commit crimes in a way that feels validating. Unfortunately, this was not.
Yeah. I was pretty disappointed in this one. I also found, obviously, Ethan Hawke is great, and Patricia Arquette is great. And I thought the girl that played Amber was pretty good, too. But I definitely felt like this portion of the story had the weakest acting out of all three of the portions.
Yeah. I agree. I loved all those. And Patricia Arquette, Ethan Hawke, were in previous Linklater movies.
Mm-hmm.
I already mentioned, you know, Patricia Arquette was in Boyhood, and then Ethan Hawke was in the Before trilogy. So, it was nice to kind of see those familiar faces come back.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else, or should we move on to the final one?
I think we can move on to the last one.
Okay. Raul, his love interest Sylvia, and Sylvia's sister Coco are illegal immigrants from Mexico trying to make it in Colorado. They all go to the Uniglobe plant in hopes of finding a job. Raul becomes a cleaner while Coco works on the meat processing conveyor belt. Sylvia, however, cannot take the environment and instead finds a job as a hotel maid. Coco develops a drug habit and begins an affair with her exploitive superior, Mike. In a work accident, a friend of Raul's falls on a machine and his leg is mangled. Raul, attempting to save him, falls and is injured. At the hospital, Sylvia is told that Raul was on amphetamines at work. Because Raul is now unable to work, Sylvia has sex with Mike in order to find a job at Uniglobe. She ends up working on the kill floor. After making her way through the floor, she sees multiple cows being slaughtered and butchered. Realizing that this is her life now, Sylvia breaks down in tears as she begins her new job. This storyline felt the most, like, the other two felt like they were in the same movie, and this one felt like it was in a totally different movie.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Cannavale as Mike was unhinged as this, like, superior who is just mistreating everybody, having sex with everybody, doing drugs, soldering cows. I the whole time I was like, what is going on? And then again, you see, like, a lot of the meatpacking plant here and a lot of meat and, like, cows and guts. There's a point where they have to like learn how to take the kidneys out of the guts. Mm-hmm. It was a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this portion of the movie, now that I'm thinking about it, is probably one. It's, I think, my favorite, has the most emotional stakes and everything like that, and was the easiest on a human level to get invested in for me personally. But for two, I think that this is probably the main reason that the grossness of everything is probably the main reason why this movie didn't try to tell the story. Like, first third is going to be Dawn. Second third is going to be Amber. Third, last third is going to be Raul. Like, if you had to sit through half an hour of all of this, their story, back to back to back to back to back, you, I think, would be left exhausted. And so spacing it out throughout the rest of the movie is probably how they were able to get away with it. And I just realized that just now, because I previously thought that it would probably have been better just one third, one third, one third. But I don't know that I could tolerate half an hour of seeing how poorly they're treated and how horribly the cows are treated all at once.
Yeah. And again, I feel like the immigrant, the way the immigrants, undocumented immigrants are treated, was sort of, I think, the core of the message, but was kind of lost in some of the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And just the absolute disparity of, well, we have to do amphetamines because that's the only way we can keep up with the job because it's really demanding. And then we get hurt and the lawyer's like, he was on amphetamines, so it's kind of on him.
Yeah.
And like a guy's leg just got chopped off.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of liked that we didn't know what ended up happening with that guy, because was that guy on amphetamines too? And he's ceremoniously dumped by the company as soon as they do what they have to do to try to pawn him off on the local hospital or whatever. I kind of liked that ambiguous aspect of it and the lack of understanding of, one, everybody who benefits from the work of illegal immigrants or immigrants in general. And then two, kind of the lack of understanding of, from the immigrant's perspective, of like, why am I being treated so horribly when I'm doing the shit work that none of you guys want to do? And I thought that that dynamic was really interesting to see played out. I don't know that I totally needed all the drug stuff as well and the abusive manager stuff. It felt like maybe those are even something that could have been in different stories, like the, maybe in the Dawn story or in the Amber story. So having it all three tied up together was a lot. But I enjoyed watching this stuff and connecting with it on that human level for sure.
Yeah. I was wondering as we were talking, I was kind of wondering, I think if this were made today, having it be like an 8-episode miniseries, would have worked a lot better for me.
For sure.
This plot line in particular, I got lost often because we start with them crossing the border and they're, there's like a coyote leaving them and we don't get a great introduction to them. Like there's that one guy who you meet for a little bit and then gets lost when they, are getting picked up. And then, you see him once later and he's like dehydrated in the desert. And I think we are supposed to assume he died. Does the kid at the end find his shoes or something?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So, and I wasn't sure, like, did they know that person? Cause he was kind of flirting with Coco a little bit and like, hey, how's it going? And then he just sort of disappears. And then at the end, Raul is described as Sylvia's husband.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like earlier in the movie, they had just started dating. And I was like, did they get married? And we just skipped over that. Or was that just like the company's just sort of like, ah, they're together. They must be married. That wasn't clear to me. So I just kind of felt like we cut a lot. We skipped around a lot there and time moved quickly. And a lot of it's kind of like Raul being like, hey, I want to take care of you. I'm going to save up money. We're going to buy a vehicle and all this stuff. And then Coco, Sylvia's sister, starts to completely lose it, becomes jealous and controlling, and doing amphetamines. Does she find out that Sylvia sleeps with Pete or whatever his name was? Mike? Does she find out?
I don't know that are you saying that Coco finds out that Sylvia sleeps with Mike, or Sylvia find out?
No,
that Coco...
So Sylvia sleeps with Mike to get a job there.
Mm-hmm.
But Coco was so controlling and like jealous of anyone talking to Mike
mm-hmm.
before that. But does Coco find out that Sylvia slept with him?
I don't believe she does. Not in the movie. I have no idea.
That all happens super fast. Yeah. Where she's like, I need a job. Let's go to your truck and bang. Okay. Here we are. Oh, the kill floor. And then she's like breaking down. That just all happens really fast.
Yeah. Way too fast.
And it had all this setup of being like, well, Coco is going to kill someone if they touch Mike. But then it just cuts away. So,
it was confusing and unsatisfying, and it was my favorite of the three storylines. So I think that says a lot about what I thought about the movie.
Yeah.
It's okay, so interesting because we're talking about like stuff within the movie, and we're agreeing on a lot of this stuff, and then yet we're still coming at it out of it with totally different perspectives on whether or not it was worth it. I guess I've shared a lot about what I don't love about it. What are some of the things that you do really like about it?
So I thought the pacing felt really good to me, and I thought the script worked really well. Like the actual dialogue mostly all worked for me. Some of the acting was a little hit or miss, but the anytime two people were on camera just talking, I thought that was like all super interesting and captivating. And it was filmed in Colorado and Texas, and I thought the locations all felt real. I thought that the motivations of a lot of the characters made a lot of sense. I don't remember if I've talked about this on air, but I worked at McDonald's for like 3 years when I was a teenager.
Oh yeah. I don't think I knew that.
So it was fun to sort of get a, like remember my time and working at fast food and sort of like, oh, I remember the crazy hijinks people would get up to and all this stuff.
Is it around the same time that this movie came out that you were working there?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah. Yeah. Like 2004 to 2006 probably.
Yeah.
No, 2002 to 2005.
Yeah.
So yeah, right before this came out, what I thought was interesting was, and this like fictional Mickey's, is definitely on the lower end of the like chains, right? It doesn't have near the budget that like a McDonald's or Burger King does.
Yeah.
But it definitely felt, like lower quality than working like the McDonald's did. Like I remember when I worked at McDonald's, so years before this movie came out, all their POS systems were digital. So they had upgraded from the like button kind that you see them using in this.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the way that this is maybe getting a little too into the weeds, but here we are. like when you order something and then someone in the back would make it, and then there'd be like a conveyor belt system or like a tray or something that would get it passed down. And that was a change in the 2000s and 90s from the way it used to be, where someone would just be hammering out Big Macs, and then they'd have like the Big Mac pile, and someone would order a Big Mac, and you go to the Big Mac pile and you take one off the Big Mac pile. Then in the 90s, they made this whole thing like, make it your way. Like if you want it without tomato, we'll make it without tomato.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed because it used to be really fast. They'd make a whole bunch and then they'd give you what they had. The way this restaurant was set up, it looked like it was more that older, we're going to make a whole bunch and have the like Big Mac piles, and that's how you pull them off of, versus the way it used to be.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, that's kind of strange, but maybe they just filmed it in an old McDonald's that no one ever upgraded.
Or it's possible that they were writing, all the people who are writing and doing the set design and stuff like that worked in McDonald's 10 years earlier.
It's true. Yeah.
They're just using their own experience there.
True. Yeah, I thought it was fun and interesting, and I've liked a lot of other Linklater stuff, and I definitely don't, this is nowhere near as good as the other movies I mentioned, but I still thought it was kind of interesting, and I think some people might get a kick out of watching it. So, yeah.
Nice. Right on. Do you feel like you have anything you wanted to say about that third plot line? I know we kind of moved on to the overall movie, but do you have anything to add?
Not particularly. Again, I kind of liked all their interactions and discussions. I loved Wilmer Valderrama. I'm not sure if I'm saying his last name right. The guy who plays Raul. Mm-hmm. Most well known probably as playing the character Fez from That 70s Show. I had not seen him in anything outside of That 70s Show before.
Oh my God. I did not realize that that was him.
And I was like, whoa, what's he doing here? And I went to his IMDb page, and he's been in a bunch of like random TV shows and other different stuff. But I was like, dang, he's pretty good in this movie. I thought that was fun and interesting to watch.
Oh yeah, no, he's great. It's funny. A little bit of wig will apparently let me just completely forget that that's Fez.
Yeah. It's like the Clark Kent effect.
I know. Well, he has like a drastically different accent too, and that's how
yeah.
the show. But
yes, yeah. exactly.
No, he is he is great. I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I definitely would not have clicked that in my brain, and I would have moved on and lived my life happily. But now I get to live my life with that knowledge, which is even happier. So,
yeah.
One thing that I had a question about in that third storyline before we move on is, I'm really confused as to why Sylvia quit her job at the hotel that she was working at. Did that ever get explained? And I just missed it.
So when she starts working there, the person training her is like, yeah, we don't make as much money as they make at the meat packing plant, but it's just a way better job. And then when Raul gets hurt and she's like, well, I have to make more money.
Gotcha.
So to the meat packing plant I go. I don't know why. I thought it would have been interesting to see her go work at Mickey's, and she's like handling the product that her sister is killing herself to make or something. I thought that could have been interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like a lot of storylines were brief just for the sake of brevity, and they gloss over a lot of details that I think we're easy to miss, but I think a miniseries would have been fun on this.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I'd watch the hell out of a miniseries on it.
Yeah. So. All right. Let's talk some trivia bits before we go into the Bruce Willis of it all.
Sounds good. What trivia stuff do you have for us?
Well, I was teeing you up for some trivia stuff that you had written down, Josh.
Oh, I see. I guess it's trivia adjacent, so yeah, we can go over that. One thing that I was going to say that I found interesting is just reading through the Wikipedia page for this movie and what the reviews were of the time and how people thought about it. Obviously, New York Times loved this movie. They bragged about it in the trailer. We talked about it earlier. And I found myself really agreeing with Ruth Stein of the San Francisco Chronicle, who wrote that for all the filmmakers' good intentions, Fast Food Nation isn't a particularly good movie. It doesn't hold together or grip you the way a documentary might have. The people are sketchily drawn. Just when you start to care about one of them, he or she vanishes. To get the consumer beware message across, much of the dialogue sounds like preaching, an unnatural way to talk in what's billed as entertainment. But it does get its message across. You're unlikely to leave the theater with a hankering for a fast food patty of any size. And I feel pretty strongly that this is the most like my opinion of all the reviews that I read out there. So I just wanted to shout out Ruth. Thank you for all that you have done for the reviewing industry, specifically regarding the movie Fast Food Nation, released in 2006.
I also guess I do have some trivia I was going to call out. Richard Linklater was nominated for the Palme d'Or at the 2006 Cannes Film Festival for this. Wow. Did not win. But that would have probably been the best award a Bruce Willis movie had gotten, is the Palme d'Or. And the Imagine Foundation nominated Wilder Valderrama as for Best Actor for this movie.
Oh, nice.
Which I had never heard of the Imagine Foundation. Imogen, I'm not sure how to say that, but it is a organization dedicated to encouraging and recognizing the positive portrayal of Latinos in the entertainment industry.
Right on.
Founded in 1983. So, yeah, good times. But yeah, I going back to what you were saying, I do agree with that. Some of the feelings there from Ruth Stein on that review. Good summation.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. All right, I'm going to move on to box office numbers, if that's all right.
Go for it.
Okay. So this movie, in the box office, made $2.209322. So they have it down to the dollar, how much this movie made in the box office. Did not do incredibly well in DVD rentals. And I only know that because I was diving deeply into this movie to try to figure out what the fuck the box office or the budget was. And there are no public numbers for what the budget for this movie would have been. I would estimate that since there were a lot of companies that put money into it and we have the exact box office down to the dollar, and they did not brag about how much more this movie made than they spent, I would guess that they lost money.
The big and the little ones are described in that budget.
Yeah. I would guess that they spent more big ones than they got back. That's my guesstimate. Just based on a movie with a cast this size, even if all of your cast is taking major pay cuts, which we'll get to Bruce Willis in a second, I don't think that that would have been his case. Even if all the cast is taking major pay cuts for this movie, I think that even with just the location shooting and all the crew, you're looking at easily a couple million for this movie, likely a bit more, plus the actors on top of that. So yeah, it probably lost a fair amount of money, but you know, it was an important movie for the filmmaker and everything, and I'm glad that it got made. Even if I, like I've said before, didn't necessarily love it.
Yeah, that's surprising. Because that's not a lot of money, and I don't think it would have taken that much. Like that's much less than some films' opening weekend. Mm-hmm. So. With that cast, you'd think they'd have an okay opening weekend, and then, you know, people would be like, "Ugh, I don't want this anymore." And then it would have a deep dive, but just that bad to begin with.
Yeah.
Maybe people were like, "I don't want to go hear about my, food."
Yeah, I think that was probably it. I think also it's, I don't know that it was marketed terribly well or had much put in the marketing budget in general for the movie. And I think also it's a hard movie to market. Even if you did market it better, I think it's hard to sell what sort of movie this is and who should watch it and everything like that. I think that that's a big challenge that I'm sure that the editor of the trailer was just like, what the fuck is this movie? How am I supposed to get people in seats? So,
I also looked it up. One, maybe you said this and I missed it, but 1 million of that is domestic and 1.2 is international. So that's opening weekend of $410,000, is not many places. I'm trying to look up and see if there's anything else that was released. Like if there's like a big movie that came out that week. It was Thanksgiving week that it opened.
Yeah, it opened in 321 theaters, an average of like a little less than $400 a theater on opening Friday. That's like a little more than a dollar per theater.
Mm-hmm.
Sheesh.
Yeah. It's like the lowest performing, because we would consider that a wide release, right? Or is that not a wide release?
I don't know. 321 theaters doesn't seem like a ton, but
yeah.
It
made in between Breakfast of Champions and In Country.
So it was 18th the weekend it opened at the box office. Number one was Casino Royale.
Oh.
And number two is Happy Feet.
Oh. Just how are you supposed to compete against Casino Royale, though?
Yeah, so Casino Royale opened in 3,434 theaters.
Okay.
And it was averaging $4,000, $4,200 a theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I would say that that's probably more than a dollar a theater if I had to if I had to guess.
Yeah. Oh man. Man. Oh, Borat, those Borat Stranger Than Fiction were also in theaters at the time. Saw 3. Yeah. The Prestige was in its 8th week. So there was a lot going on.
Bummer. Bummer. I think this movie would also do better released in streaming than it would in movie theaters. Because you get a lot of people talking about it if it was released today. And if you got people talking about it and it was on streaming, I think that you'd get some pretty good numbers out of it. Because, I don't know, if I hear some stranger on the internet being like, yeah, this movie's great, it's wild, it's insane, you have to see it. And it's on streaming, I'm way more likely to watch it than if they're like, yeah, it's great, it's wild, you got to get yourself to a theater to see it. I'm like, I don't know, stranger on the internet, 69 420, I'm good, I'm actually just gonna stay home. So,
also, man, I'm just like listening off the sad notes here. So Fast Food Nation was 18th that opening day on the 17th.
Yeah.
And it made 126,000 that day in 321 theaters. Also opening that day was this movie called For Your Consideration, which I don't think I'd ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
But it opened in 23 theaters and made $110,000. So $15,000 less and like a tenth of the theaters.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, what happened? Man, I'm just like, what happened to that movie?
Yeah. I can't even imagine watching this in a theater either. Just
yeah, because like what if you get a burger at the theater and then you sit down and you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
So, yikes. All right. Moving on. Let's talk about Bruce Willis. So we said he's in the movie for probably not even 10 minutes. And he's like clean shaven, hard ass. Again, it's not super clear. They're at a different restaurant than Bucky's. And I didn't know, like, was it a sister restaurant to Bucky's?
Or to Mickey's?
Yeah, sorry, Mickey's. And I was like, where are they? Why are they here? And what? And they make a big point about how good the food is there. And I was like, did I miss something? Like, what is going on? But basically, he's just there to tell Don, like, yeah, we know, but we don't care because it's cheap. Not super notable as far as the Bruce Willis performances go, but if you had known how uninvolved he was in this movie, would you have said we should skip this movie?
Yeah, 100%. What about you?
I'm glad I watched it. I don't know. I'm glad I watched that. I don't know if it merits like a discussion on a Bruce Willis podcast or not. But
yeah, I mean, because like he's good and he's bald again, which is fun to see. Because
he plays like a hard ass and
yeah. I mean, he's just as engaging in that character as Ethan Hawke was as his character. around that level, and I don't know, it was good. It was fine. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, there's not a ton to say. We just watching him chomp down on a burger for a few minutes and then drink a couple beers.
Yeah. And ogle out a waitress for a second. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Also, I thought I was like, is that his wife or something? Cause he made like some personal comment about her. Like, oh yeah. And I was like, is he there? Cause his wife works there. Cause at the beginning you don't know who he is. And then he was like, obviously ogling her or touching her or something. And I was just like, this is all really, what's going on right now?
Mm-hmm.
And I wish we had had more time to be like, watch Bruce Willis be slimy, be a slimy meatball and do some stuff and then show up and you know what kind of character he is.
Yeah. No. Yeah, 100%. I feel like he was probably there for like a day and
got
paid like a quarter, probably a million dollars just for that.
Man.
Yeah.
You mean 75 days at the theater for this movie or something?
Yeah.
Yikes. You never know. I tried to find out, you know, oftentimes we've mentioned Bruce Willis takes a project pretty cheaply because he wants to work with that filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe that might be the case here because Linklater's done a lot of great stuff. But I didn't find that either way.
Yeah. I feel like if that was the case, it probably there'd be some sort of statement saying that, oh, I just really wanted to take this role so I could work with him.
Like he did with Tarantino.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think that maybe it was more of a money thing for Bruce, because obviously he was a little bit more liberal in when he was younger, but as he grew older, he was more conservative. And this movie, even though they make a point to be like, yeah, liberals and conservatives are both the problem, it's definitely got like a leftist message to it. And so I think that if Bruce Willis was fully aware of that beforehand, I would guess that it's more of a money thing rather than a passion project for him.
Interesting.
But, yeah.
That's an interesting thought. Well, another question I had for you, at some point in that conversation, Bruce Willis makes a comment about how it's not as if President Eisenhower is around. And I was like, is Eisenhower known on cracking down on businesses, or like, what was with the Eisenhower quote?
I have a political science degree, so I'm really glad that you asked me. I have no idea either.
I was like, of all the presidents to pick that would be like hard on business, I'm not even sure who I would pick, but I don't know if that's what Eisenhower is known for.
Did he have like a really really big top line like tax thing going on or whatever? I'm so confused. I'm gonna go look it up.
Okay, because I from my limited memory of that era, because I was alive then, but it was like he was like a war hero, so that's sort of like how he got his campaign going, and then he did a lot of public works projects, right? I think he did like a lot of our highway systems were sort of kicked off by him, but I don't recall there being like, oh, we have to crack down on businesses being terrible sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It
looks like he might have been that way. McKinsey.com has an article in Leadership on him and says that it seems like that might have been his kind of go-to. Let's see. Which I'm so excited to refer to the Kinsey Institute as the McKinsey Institute, because one of the greats in making sure that we do not have the rights that we should have today. Big, big lobbyists. They said I would.
Well, there goes our funding.
Yeah, exactly. They said I would stress, though, that Eisenhower did not believe that corporations should transform themselves into behemoths and acquire wealth for only a select few. The notion of corporate greed was anathema to him. Yes, thank you. He felt that corporations were at their best when they worked in the public interest.
Yeah. Okay. Then that makes sense. Man, Eisenhower sounds like a good guy. I'm curious when the political or when the legal standing was that corporations can be treated like a person. Because I feel like that would have been the early 1900s, but
I think it was a lot more recent than that.
Well, if you know the answer, email us at williswaypod.
Yeah. Let us know. Let us know. Oh, man. Corporate personhood. I think one of the other things that, other than that Eisenhower comment, that kind of instantly dated this movie was just the 2006-ness of it all. As you're watching it, like, there's a Hollywood Video jump scare, like,
yes, 20 minutes yes. into the movie. Like, also, oh, they're shopping on Overstock.com at uh-huh. the beginning, and it is like the grainiest website of, like, I'm like, I could hear the dial-up as they're like slowly scrolling the pictures on Overstock yeah. as he's like trying to buy some stuff.
Oh, yeah, it was man. so good. Definitely a nostalgia trip in that way, but.
Yep.
That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Do you have any other Willis-related stuff to get to before we hop into the closing?
Nope. That's it.
Sounds good. Before we close, we always like to do that one thing that we always do, and mm-hmm. that is...
We never not do that thing we do.
We never not do that thing we do. I love that song, by the way, the Never Not Do the Things We Do for Love. You're mm-hmm. familiar with it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn. What you're referring to, though, of course, is the Wheel of Willis.
The Wheel of Willis.
And in order to whisk the wheel, we have to say an incantation.
Yeah.
And the incantation is always said perfectly and in sync and at the same time. And that incantation is...
Whisk that wheel. Have fun editing that, whoever edits that. All right. So this question does not have credit, unfortunately. But the question is, this Bruce Willis character is your server at Applebee's. What percent are you tipping?
I have a hard stance on never tipping less than 20%, mm-hmm. even if they're terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd have to say 19%.
19%. I think that if he wasn't actively ogling anybody, he probably would come off as perfectly fine and adequate. And so I probably would give him exactly 20% as well.
But if you know what you know about him. Like, I guess, yeah. Do you know that he's this person? Or is he just serving you a burger and a couple of New Belgiums?
I would assume that we wouldn't know anything about his character. If I knew things about his character, obviously, I'd be like, why are you a server at Applebee's? You should be making bazillions yeah. of dollars.
Exploiting us all.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? I probably would still tip him because I don't know. I hate the idea of not tipping somebody. And for those of you that are not in America, you don't understand what it's like. Corporations have decided to pass on about 20% of the responsibility of their employees' wages to us as product buyers. So, and they don't tell us. Up front, we just have to do it afterwards or forever feel guilty about it. So that's the way things work in the greatest country on earth.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of Where There's a Willis, There's a Way. Please rate us on Apple Podcasts. We will read your reviews on air if we remember to check before we record, which I did not do this time. But normally we always remember because we're smart and good. And again, if you want to send us an email, you can head on over to your email and do that. And Josh is going to tell you how.
You can send an email to us at williswaypod@gmail.com. You can also follow us on, are we on Blue Sky? I can't remember.
Yes, we are.
Okay. Yeah. You can follow us on Blue Sky at Willis Way Pod, as well as Instagram and TikTok. We don't hardly ever post to Insta or TikTok, but if we get the hankering, we'll be dankering. That's what I always say. So follow along to see some good danks.
Yeah. We should post an Instagram live from us at a burger joint.
That'd be good.
asking them about their fecal content.
And we'll shout out Paul Dano at the end so that it gets a million views.
Okay, and you can find me on Blue Sky or other places at K Martinix, KMARTINIX, or you can see everything else I do at kmartinix.com.
You can find me on Blue Sky at Joshing Carter, and you can follow me on Instagram by searching for Prov Josh. And every episode, we like to end our podcast with a little tasty treat to close out the show. So, Kendrick, what is your sweet treat?
I'm going to be talking about the book series called Malazan Books of the Fallen. Mm. It is a 10-book fantasy series, and it is some of the most unhinged fantasy concepts that I have ever heard of. And each book is mind-bendingly hard to understand, and at the end you're like, what did I just read? And then you sort of think back through it and you're just like, that was the greatest thing I've ever read. I'm currently about a third of the way through book 3. And if you like fantasy or you don't like fantasy, you should read this book anyways. It's Malazan Books of the Fallen.
That sounds
The first one is called Gardens of the Moon.
Do they go to the moon in the book, or is it a...
So it's not really explained, but you come throughout the book to find out that there's like one of the gods is like this, moon lord, and he has a floating moon base and he flies it around above the land, and he uses that to like attack the armies below. And then there's like armies below that have wizards that shoot spells up at the moon base. And then these dragons kind of like go back and forth.
That
but you're not
amazing.
Really, you're not really told this. It's just describing like the moon, and you're like, wait, like the literal moon? And then at the end, you're like, yeah, I guess it is the literal moon, just flying around, and that's where this guy lives with his people.
That's incredible.
That's one of like 100 things in one book that you're just like, what?
That's so good. I'm pretty sure that they should take the James Bond series in that direction next. They should have a bad guy up on the moon running that as his base. So,
yeah. So, small connection to your all-time tasty treat, Baldur's Gate 3, but the author of these books, Steven Erikson, started a RPG campaign, a pen and paper RPG campaign, and he converted the campaign to the books. That's how he started writing these books, was it was like the world building for his RPG. It wasn't D&D. I don't remember what rule set he was using, but he was basically building out a world, and he's like, I'm going to write a book about this.
That's rad. That's so, so rad. That is kind of, isn't that kind of what Tolkien did as well? He started like developing the world and the languages and the cultures and everything, and it was like...
Oh, yeah. I was like, I don't think he's played D&D. And then I was like, I'm going to...
Oh my god. If you have an idea of which race and characters which race and class you think that Tolkien would have played as in game of D&D, please send that in to us. We'd be most excited to see that. Those books sound awesome.
What's your sweet treat, Josh?
My sweet treat is going to be another video game. I am going to shout out the game Deep Rock Galactic. I have been playing it a lot with my buds. I have I think I said it at maybe during the Over the Hedge episode or whatever, but I have a broken ankle right now, and I've been out of work for a bit because I work on site, so it's not really a job that I can do remotely. And so I've had a lot of extra time to consume media, and video games are a great way to pass the time, and I've been playing a lot of this game. You play as a dwarf in outer space who is working for a corporation that tells you to go mine for minerals on this planet, and the voice lines are really funny. It's a multiplayer game, so there's lots of shenanigans that can happen. It's a co-op multiplayer game, so you're working with your buddies as you go to explore everything and mine all the minerals and kill the creatures and spiders and stuff that attack you. So it's a pleasant little game. It's like $30 and the developers are super rad. So I just wanted to shout out Deep Rock Galactic. And next week, next time. I don't know why I said next week. It's not going to be next week. Do not expect it next week. Don't email us next week. Next time, we're going to be covering the Tarantino movie and the Rodriguez movie and the Edgar Wright movie, Grindhouse.
Bow, 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 bow. Have you seen this before?
I have not. I'm really excited to watch it because I've heard it's interesting.
Yeah,
so I'm really excited to watch it.
It is something. It's definitely something.
Yep. So join us then. Until then.
All right.
Adios.
Bye-bye.
Well, do you want to go back and re-record it?
No. Lesson one of improv is you just go with it.
Good job, yes, Andy, and my bullshit. I appreciate that.
I was like, did I miss something? Because I swear we just talked about this.